great to be with you. I want to invite you to turn to the book of Matthew, chapter 4. And we'll start there at some point. We'll get there at some point. So we may stop off at a few places. When I asked Ed what was going on in the conference and all that, he said, you know, I don't give anybody any topics or anything, but the central thing he was going to be talking about was questions. And then he says, well, you just talk about whatever you want, which is like a great thing to hear, isn't it? Really. He says, I'll just turn loose. He's got like an hour. Just go. So I thought I'd talk about questions, and we'll see where it goes. I want to talk about the world of Jesus, and I want to talk about the questions that were circulating in the first century Jewish world of Jesus. And if you don't know much about him, or you ought to read some of the stuff he said, because it's great, great, great stuff. That joke was like, there it went. Move on. Jesus was a first century Jewish rabbi. And in a first century Jewish rabbi world, there's a whole context that he lived and taught in. And so I want to give a bunch of background, and then I want to go to Matthew 4, and then a couple other passages, and ask some real basic questions. And then from there, I want to move to what does that mean for you and I as we try and lead this Jesus revolution that we're all dying to be a part of. Now, Jesus lived in an intensely Orthodox region of the Galilee on the north side of the Sea of Galilee called the Triangle, three main cities where Orthodox Judaism in the north had kind of its capital. Now, central to the life of a Jew in the first century was the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. Torah is spelled T-O-R-A-H. Let me hear you say Torah. Okay, now you got to say it with some in your thing. Torah. To a Jew in the first century, Torah was everything. God, the book of the words of God, the book of Moses, also called the Pentateuch, the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, were central. They believed that at a point in their actual history, God had spoken and given them a way to live. And so the way to live in harmony with God was to live the Torah. Now, the phrase they used for harmony with God was the phrase Olam Haba. Let me hear you say Olam Haba. So the dominant question was, how do I obtain Olam Haba? Harmony with God, also translated life in the world to come. Eternal life is the way it was translated. How do I live the kind of life now that I'll be living in harmony with God now and forever? What's the best possible kind of life? This was the dominant question. And so you debated, you discussed, how do I live the Torah to its fullest? And so the question was, with the first five books and all of the commands and regulations and teachings, at what age do you begin teaching a child the Torah? The Talmud, a compendium of 500 years after Jesus, Jewish writings, one rabbi says, up until the age of six, we do not teach Torah. But from six upwards, we stuff them with Torah like an ox. So in Jesus' day, the general belief was that sometime around five or six-ish, a child had heard in their home and in the synagogue the Torah. They'd heard it memorized. They'd heard it spoken. But the general belief was that sometime around the age of five or six, as a good Jewish boy or girl, you would go to the village synagogue during the week and you would begin learning the Torah. Now, this first stage of education was called Beit Sefer, B-E-T-S-E-F-E-R. It looks like Bet Sefer, but let me hear you say Beit Sefer. And so as a good Jewish boy or girl, the first stage of education, and once again, these are approximations, lasted roughly five or six to ages 10. You would go and in the beginning, perhaps the rabbi would take honey, which was an unbelievably rare delicacy. And the rabbi would take honey and place it on your finger. And you got honey once in a great while. And the rabbi would say, now lick the honey, my child, may the words of Torah be like honey on your tongue. And so from an early age, the words of God were like burned into your consciousness as the most beautiful, enjoyable like a feast, like the greatest thing you could imagine, was to live and to know and to speak and to question and to wrestle with the words of God. May the words of Torah be like honey on your tongue. Now, from the ages of roughly 6 to 10 in Beit Sefer, you would memorize the Torah. By the age of 10 in Jesus' day, most kids, Torah memorized. Genesis, memorized. Exodus, memorized. Leviticus, memorized. Some of you will get that like a day later. Oh, Numbers, memorized. Deuteronomy, memorized. So if you notice, by the way, in the Gospels, when Jesus is quoting these little fragments and everybody seems to know what he's talking about, it's because the text was the words of God. And how do you live them? How does the word take on flesh and blood? How do we live it? Now, Torah sometimes is translated in the Hebrew scriptures, sometimes it's translated law, decree, commands, statutes, precepts, teachings, instructions. The Hebrew words are nimble. They can be translated a bunch of different ways. Probably the best translation of Torah would simply be way. It was the way. So the rabbis would refer to Torah as the way. They'd refer to as truth. They would refer to Torah as life. Are we preaching yet? Yeah, come on now. Come on. Oh, by the way, okay. But I was speaking at this Pentecostal pastors conference. And so I'm talking, and there's a guy in the front row. I like, da-da-da-da-da-da, Torah. Da-da-da-da-da. And this guy's going, mm-mm. Then I do a little more thing, like, da-da-da-da-da-da, Rabbi says, Bible verse, da. And he go, mm-mm. And at one point, I'm building up the head of steam, and I did my, like, something, quote something, something. And he goes, mm-mm, what are you doing to me now? I don't know. So, no idea what that has to do with anything. Let me check my notes. So, the Torah is everything. Now, the best of the best of the best of the best in Jesus' day became rabbis. The best of the best. How many of you played basketball in elementary school? How many of you played in high school? How many of you played in college for more than 2.5 years? How many of you played... I don't know why I said that. I just picked that number randomly. How many of you went on to play pro? And then how many of you will be playing in the All-Star game? Okay, so you have this sense with basketball, like the best of the best of the best keep going. And there are these few NBA All-Stars who over time are like the 2, 3, 4, 5, 10. If you understand that, then you understand what it meant to be a rabbi in the first century. The best of the best of the best of the best of the smartest, quickest, brightest, most creative actually became rabbis. So by the age of 10, most kids are dropping out of school. Very, very, very few kids would go on with formal education. Because only a few are going to be the best of 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 the best all-stars. Most kids are going to begin learning the family trade. So your family makes sandals. Your family has a vineyard. Your family has an olive press. Your family does wheat. By the age of 10, most kids are learning how to manage a household, learning whatever the family trade is. But a few would continue on to the next level of Jewish education, which was called Beit Talmud. Let me hear you say Beit Talmud. Now, Beit Talmud roughly lasted 10 to 14 or 15 years of age. In Beit Talmud, the best of the best who were still going would memorize the rest of the Hebrew scriptures. By the age of 13 or 14, the entire Hebrew scriptures memorized, Genesis through to the Italian prophet Malachi. Memorized. A friend of mine studied at a yeshiva, a Jewish seminary in Manhattan in the mid-80s. And in the mid-80s in Manhattan, he's a Christian who wanted to understand better the world of Jesus. So he's the only Christian in this Jewish setting. He said, Rob, I was the only one in the school who did not have the entire Old Testament memorized. So when we talk about, you know, so-and-so knows the word, in Jesus' day, knowing the word, everybody knows the word. And the best of the best of the best can do things. I've seen things. We'll get to that in a minute. So in Beit Talmud, you also would learn the Jewish art of questions. Questions and answers. See, for us, many of us are educated in Western settings where the prize goes to those who can spit back the facts as quickly and as definitively as possible. So the professor lectures, you take notes, and at the exam time, you need to bring back out the proper information at the proper time. And not that it's all education, but for many of us, for us, education is the transmission of information. In an Eastern setting, and specifically a Jewish rabbinical setting, education wasn't just who can spit out the facts, but it's who can take it, turn it, twist it, process, think about it, and then take the discussion farther. So the question wasn't just who can spit back what the rabbi said, it's who can take what the rabbi said, think about it, turn it, probe it, poke it, and then ask a question that demonstrates that you want to take the discussion to the next level. Have you noticed how many places in the Gospels when Jesus is asked a question, what does he respond with? A question. And we read it as Westerners and go, Jesus, would you just say something? And he's like, why do you want me to say something? Or it's always this. It's because the very Eastern way of thinking, that just spouting back information, who cares? Who can take the discussion to that? So questions were central. And as a young kid in Beit Talmud, you'd begin learning about the oral tradition because you had the Torah and the prophets and the Psalms. But then you had this giant oral tradition that surrounded the scriptures. So Rashi said this about Genesis 2. And how does that relate to what Rambam says? And Rabbi Shlomo said this. And so not only would you know the whole Hebrew scripture, but you could rattle off who said what about this. And so you might say Rabbi Shlomo, in the name of Rabbi Gorin, quotes Rashi, who says about Genesis 17, behold, I, mind-blowing. They also can ask, you would ask questions, you would get asked questions, and the question was, how well did you know the scriptures? The book of Hosea mentions and quotes from Deuteronomy 17 times. Give me the references, every other one backwards. Boom, 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 boom. Just nail it. Questions, you can't even believe the degree to which, if these are the words of God, they demand everything that we have. Are we preaching yet? So this isn't a casual, well, that's just what it says. It's a, why does it say that? A friend of mine was studying with a rabbi in Israel last year. He's taking classes, and the rabbi, I believe he was Orthodox in tradition. This was the assignment. Genesis 22 is your assignment. Come up with every question you can imagine about Genesis 22 and the story of Abraham giving his son. That's your assignment. So my friend Kent comes back to class, you know, and he's got his list. And the rabbi's like, you. And so this one student, why is? He says, okay, you. Another student lists, why, I don't understand why this. And then he says, the rabbi just blows his stack. This is an offense to God. This is all of the questions you can find in Genesis 22. Why does it say the son whom you love? It's the first mention of the word love. Why is love first mentioned in Genesis 22? Why does Abraham say to his servant, the boy and I will go, wait here, we'll come back. But if he's sacrificing his son, then why does he say we will come back? Why now does a servant go 3 days? And why for 3 days does Abraham think that his son is as good as dead? But then on the third day you find out that the son is alive because of an act of God. Why? And he says the rabbi just goes, and all these things none of them had begun to think of. The rabbi was offended that they didn't have that many questions of the text. Why? Because it's the words of God and it demands to be engaged. It reads you as much as you read it. So in Beit Talmud as a student, you would learn the art of questions. By the way, Beit Talmud, ages 10 to 14 or 15, when Jesus' parents find him in the temple, Luke chapter 2, what's he doing with the wise men? He's asking them what? Questions. If Jesus is a good Jewish boy, would he have been in Beit Talmud? Luke says that he grew in wisdom and stature. At one point, Jesus says to his disciples, everything that I learned, I pass on to you. Did Jesus go through the rabbinical system like anybody else, headed to be a rabbi. And the boy grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with men. Now, the best of the best of the best, by the end of Bet Talmud, the best of the best of the best of the best are still going. Now, at this point, if you want to become a rabbi, you need to then learn from a rabbi. Now, most rabbis taught a particular interpretation of Torah. So this rabbi might say, this is how you live Torah. Another rabbi might say, no, I have some subtle differences with so-and-so. This is the way that you live Torah. And so different rabbis had different sets of interpretations of how you live the Torah. So when you went to a rabbi and you wanted to get a feel for this rabbi's set of interpretations, you might say to this rabbi, there were a couple questions you might ask. You might say, Rabbi, which is the greatest commandment? Remind you of anything? Because then the way the rabbi might say, give to the poor. And you'd be like, oh, this rabbi has a justice, compassion, poor kind of bent. Another rabbi might say, Shema, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Oh, this rabbi has like a worship, sacrifice bent. Another rabbi might say something, be holy, as I am holy, it says in Leviticus. So each rabbi, now that rabbi's set of interpretations was called that rabbi's, or the rules that rabbi would add to the Torah, was called that rabbi's yoke. So when you followed that rabbi, and that rabbi's endless list of rules, you were taking that rabbi's yoke upon you. By the way, one rabbi came along and said, my yoke is easy. Yeah. My yoke's a bit different than the other yokes. So the question you would ask a rabbi questions, is you would go around as a student at the end of Bet Talmud wanting to become a rabbi, whose yoke do I want to take? Who do I want to be like? What rabbi do I want to do what they do? So a rabbi would be sitting and teaching, and you would come. And remember, an Eastern culture is built around images and pictures. So you might just say, you might go in when the rabbi was teaching and just sit at the rabbi's feet, which was a way of saying, Rabbi, in all humility, I want to become one of your disciples. So the rabbi then had a series of things. By the way, Jesus is at the home of two women, and the one woman is sitting at Jesus' feet. What is the question she asks when she sits at Jesus' feet? Rabbi, where do women fit in your movement? Are they second class like the other rabbis? Or can women sit at your feet like every other kind of disciple? And what does Jesus respond? Now, back from that tangent. Okay, so, whole nother teaching. Now, and all the women said, pretty pathetic, I'll be honest with you. Come on. So, you would go, now the rabbi only has so much time on this planet. And the rabbi wants to get as many people as possible teaching his interpretation of Torah, because he believes his yoke is the best, most pure way to live the Torah. Make sense? So the rabbi wants to essentially perpetuate his yoke. So the rabbi has a series of questions for this kid, because the rabbi wants to know, can this kid do what I do? Right? That's the thing. I can't spend time on some kid who's not going to be able to perpetuate my yoke. So the rabbi would ask a series of questions. The rabbi might just say, you know, tell me about this. Question about Torah, about the way he lives. Because the rabbi is trying to get at, can this kid sitting in front of me, if I poured some time into this kid, could this kid do what I do? Now, the rabbi might decide, nah, the kid doesn't have it. This kid's not NBA All-Star material. So the rabbi might say, obviously you love God, obviously you love Torah, but you don't have what it takes to be my disciple. Go continue learning the family trade. And a friend of mine always has this like kind of scene he paints of the rabbi saying, go and make lots of babies and hope they become rabbis or something. Then there's also the opportunity, the chance, that the rabbi would watch this kid, listen to this kid, question this kid and say, I think this kid can do it. I think this kid can do what I do. So the rabbi would say to the kid, Lech acharai, which means come, follow me. So you, in some cases, you would leave your family, you would leave your village, you would leave your school, you would leave your friends. In some cases, you would stop apprenticing, and you would devote your entire life to learning to do what you saw your rabbi doing. So you would leave it all behind in order to follow your rabbi, in order to learn how to be like your rabbi. Being a disciple, sometimes it gets translated student, which we immediately shift into, oh, know what the rabbi knows. No, no. Disciple, in Jesus' context, is somebody who is learning to actually do what their rabbi does. So you'd follow your rabbi all over the place. A friend of mine was in Israel. He saw a rabbi going into the restroom and his talmidim, his disciples, following him into the restroom for instructions on something, I assume. But you want to know everything. You've given up everything to do what your rabbi does. So in the hot, dusty roads of first century Israel, a wandering, traveling rabbi comes to town teaching his yoke. And behind him is this pack of hungry, passionate, full of chutzpah, mid-pubescent boys who are trying to get as close as they can because they want to be like their rabbi. And a phrase developed among the wise men and the sages. The highest kind of blessing you could say upon a talmid, a disciple, is you would say, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. It's like you saw this disciple, and he's just caked with whatever his rabbi stepped in that day. He's just got it all over, and you say, like, dude, you got dust all over the front of your cloak. Yep. Check it out. Check it out. It's like the highest honor you could pay a disciple would be, man, you're all covered in the dust of your rabbi. Thank you. Check it out. So, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. Now that my introduction is done, let's see if reading Matthew chapter 4 starts to take on some depth. Verse 18, Matthew 4:18, Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, and he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter, and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Now, if they're fishermen, and a rabbi is coming to talk to them, then what aren't they? Disciples. Come, follow me. Lech acharai, Jesus said, and I will make you fishers of men. Now, if they're fishermen, and they're not following some other rabbi, and this rabbi comes to them, then where do they rank? They're not disciples of some other rabbi. They're not the best of the best. Did some rabbi at some point say to them, you know, Peter, you're a nice guy, but you're so jumpy. Were they told at some point, you don't have what it takes? And this rabbi comes down the beach and says, you, come, follow me. Now, the next verse has always bothered me immensely, so we'll have a little recovery group right now for those. Verse 20, at once they left their nets and followed him. Now, this verse always bothered me because it was used in the sermon, message, pamphlet, whatever, as like a motivational thing, like, and you too, you got to drop your nets and follow him right now. It was supposed to be a motivational thing, but I always had the sense like, but I'm not aware that I'm currently fishing. And it also has the sense like, what do I drop? I mean, I'm 14, I play soccer. You know, like, what? Or, and then he starts, is it just everybody's supposed to drop, you know, quit their job and follow him, which makes it like, you know, the first church of the unemployed or something. How many of you, it's bothersome. You're like, I don't get it. Okay, 6 of you. Okay. Yeah, the rest of you are liars. No, it's just a strange passage. It's a strange passage. Why would you, some rabbi, we don't really know clearly if they even know him. Some guy comes down the beach and says, drop your nets, and you're like, okay. It's an odd passage, unless this is a rabbi who's beginning, rabbis generally began their public ministry at the age of 30. So sometime around the age of 30, this rabbi is now calling disciples. And he comes down the beach. Now, this rabbi has a fascinating reputation. And I don't know exactly the chronology here of Matthew 4 in relation to other passages. But this rabbi, rumor has it that this rabbi turned water into wine. This is your kind of rabbi. Okay? You know, this guy's yoke's got like an adult beverages wing to it. And you're like, well done. Okay, so rumors are starting to spread about this rabbi. There's rumors that he healed somebody from the dead. And not only that, but this rabbi... Now understand that a yoke, every once in a great while, a new yoke came along. Every once in a great... But a new yoke, a new take on God happened. It might not even happen in your generation. Generally, a rabbi taught... in the name of another rabbi. We might use the phrase denomination. What denomination are you? Oh, okay, so that person's yoke is kind of the one you're carrying out. That might be the closest modern equivalent to it. But generally a rabbi would come along and tell me about Rabbi so-and-so. Oh, he teaches in the name of Rabbi Ben-Gurion. Oh, well, I know Rabbi Ben-Gurion lived 3 centuries ago and was a famous and kind of had a particular slant, and these rabbis are all teaching. They're carrying on his yoke. So-and-so teaches the name of so-and-so. Every once in a great while, a rabbi would come along teaching a new yoke, which meant this rabbi was saying about specific passages in the Torah, you have heard it said and interpreted this way, but I tell you this is what it really means. I mean, you would hike for miles. You would forget about food and just hike out in the middle of nowhere. Are we tracking yet? To hear this. Wait. A rabbi is coming through town who's teaching a new yoke? This never happens. This rabbi, we spend our entire lives wrestling with the Torah, and this rabbi is coming along and claiming to have a new take on the words of God. Now, in order to have a new take on the words of God, you had to defend it against all the other yokes. And there's this rabbi coming down the beach who, rumor has it, is busting out a new yoke. Now, the word for having a new yoke, you could only bring about a new yoke if you had what's called, the Hebrew word is shmikah. Let me hear you say shmikah. If somebody has shmikah, it means they have the authority to make new interpretations. And you've been hearing rumors that Yeshua from Nazareth is busting the shmikah. Whoa! And not only that, but using the Torah, he's putting the religious establishment in his place because they're coming after him because a new yoke threatens all the other yokes. And he's saying, you know what? It's not about piling rules on top of people. In fact, you who keep weighing people down, you're sons of hell. My yoke is easy. He's taking on the entire religious, political, economic establishment and saying your yoke does not honor God. There's a new yoke in town and I'm busting the shmihah. This... I can't even begin to explain what this would be like. By the way, what's the question? What's the thing they say about Jesus? He didn't teach like their local Torah teachers, but he taught as one who had, and how does the New Testament translate Shmihah? This guy's different. He's not teaching somebody else's yoke. He's bringing something new. And his new shmihah, he's asking the best questions anybody. He's saying things like, what's it profit a person if you gain it all and you lose your soul? His shmihah is, he's asking questions no one's asked. And when he teaches, you can't stop thinking about it and discussing it. Give to Caesar what is Caesar, give to God. He's like confounding people because his His yoke is just so fresh, and it pushes you and it challenges you. And when you meet him, you can't just go like, I've heard all the yokes. When you hear his, it's different. And so this rabbi comes down the beach. Oh, by the way, another tangent. The way that you receive Shmiha is two people, two voices, two powerful voices who had authority or Shmiha would have to acknowledge your Shmiha. We might say like an ordination. Maybe you were ordained and some people who were already ordained laid hands on you as a way of conferring authority. If you've read the novels of Chaim Potok, you Shmiha's all through there, people trying to get Shmiha. Jesus is... So the question is, where does Jesus get his Shmiha? Jesus is being baptized. John the Baptist, who's got some authority, is saying, I'm not even worthy to untie his sandals. In Matthew chapter 3, at Jesus' baptism, other than John the Baptist, is there a second voice validating him? Not bad. Not bad. And even then, at the end of Jesus' ministry, at the end, he's in Jerusalem, and what are the religious leaders? What's their question for you? Tell us, where did you get your... Yeah, Shmiha. And what is Jesus' response? What's Jesus' response? You tell me. Where did J the B get his? Brilliant. Brilliant. You tell me, where did John the Baptist get his? They're like, Brilliant. For the six of us who get it. No, I don't know. I don't get it either. I don't really get it either. I just thought I'd say that because I'll get it later. So, where are we? Verse 21. Oh, okay. So this rabbi comes along and says to you, JV Fisher boy, who didn't make the cut, who's healing people from the dead. That's the rumor. Who's bringing a new yoke. Who's multiplying loaves and fishes, he does later. There are these rumors spreading about him, and he says to you, come follow me. If the rabbi says, come follow me, the rabbi thinks that you can do what? What the rabbi does. Of course you drop your nets. This would just be stunning. Notice how the passage continues. Going on from there, verse 21, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Zebedee then filed chapter 11. See, we don't get that word, do we? What happens to Zebedee's workforce? I always pictured Zebedee, because without the background, I always pictured Zebedee just like, you kids, you know? You picture like this, like out, you know, out following the Son of God, changing the world, you know, be back by curfew or something, just kind of vaguely authoritarian. Yeah, because it's just an odd thing. You're working with your kids and if they're working with their father, then they're apprenticing, correct? Which makes them how old? Contrary to the Easter pageant where they're 37 and have beards and leg hair. Hate to put a dent in that one for you, but I think you could compellingly argue, once again, I'm just from a little bit of the context, I think you could compellingly argue that a disciple in Jesus' day, and reading the first century sources, disciples were, well, let me ask you this, who are the most passionate people in your congregation who, if they believe they were supposed to do it, would just do it? What age would you go after? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They're just crazy enough to think that if God says they could do it, they might actually be able to do it. Yeah. And so you have Zebedee. I've run this by a friend of mine who knows this backwards. And, I mean, he's so kind of connected with this world. And he agreed. I just speculated about Zebedee coming home that night. Honey, the boys aren't with me. I could tell. No, seriously. The boys aren't coming home tonight, and they're not coming home tomorrow night. Okay. Yeah, honey, the boys left. The boys left. What do you mean? Well, the rabbi Yeshua from Nazareth, The one who the rumors have been circulating about, the one who's powerful, has authority. He came and he said, Lech Acharai, to your boys? My boys. Yeah, my boys. Yours? Yeah. Really? Yeah. This rabbi thinks that my boys can do what he does. I picture Zebedee in town the next day. As you can see, upon careful observation, my boys are not with me. And you may say to yourself, why? And I shall answer you. Because a rabbi called him to be his Talmudim. And being a disciple. And you never knew what the rabbi was going to do. At one point in Matthew, it says that Jesus was with them at Caesarea Philippi. Wait. Caesarea Philippi, that's 27 miles from the Galilee. And all the text says is, when Jesus was with them at Caesarea Philippi, Caesarea Philippi was the headquarter of the goat god Pan. It was a pagan cultic temple built into the side of the rock. And the rock had a giant crack in it, and they believed, because of the gases that came from underneath the plates of the earth, they believed that that's where the evil spirits came and went. And so the pagans, followers of Pan, built a giant temple over that crack in the rock because they believed it was the place where you could enter and exit from Hades. And so it's there that you have all of these people who are enacting all of these sexual rituals involving people and goats and stuff. It's just a sick, disgusting, as a good Jewish Orthodox boy or girl trying to live out the Torah, you were taught by your parents, you do not go to Caesarea Philippi. And what does the text say in Matthew? Jesus with his disciples at Caesarea Philippi. So apparently in Jesus' youth ministry, keeping the parents happy wasn't the number one goal. I mean, being a disciple would have been the most, like, you're following along behind your rabbi, like, where are we going? Dude, this is the road to Caesarea. Dude, you're so busted. We're going, right? You're like, what are we doing? But this was following a rabbi. When you follow the rabbi, you don't know where it's going to take you. You'd just rather be following this rabbi than anything else. Does that connect for us? You don't know. By the way, when Jesus is there at Caesarea Philippi, what does he say to them? He says to them, okay, so what do people say I am? Who do people say that I am? I tell you the truth. Upon this rock, what was that, Caesarea Philippi? A giant rock where the pagans worshipped. Upon this rock, and the Hades place was called the gates of hell because of the belief that spirits came and entered. Upon this rock, I'm going to build a new kind of community, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. What does he say to these mid-whatever pubescent boys? What did he say to them? Hikes them to Caesarea Philippi and says, see that? Upon this kind of thing, I'm going to build a new kind of witnessing community. And the gates of hell, nothing's going to be able to stop it. You'd be like, what is he? What is, you'd be like, what is it? What am I doing? Where are my nets? This is unbelievable. Remember at one point in John 6, when Jesus is doing some kind of seeker insensitive teaching and the place is just starting to scatter. And Jesus turns to the ones who are left, and he's like, well, now we got some free seats, you know. And Jesus essentially says to Peter, what does he say to them? Are you going to leave me too? And what does Peter basically say? Rabbi, we don't have any life outside of you. You know what I mean? You know, it's like Friday night, open, Saturday night, open. We have nothing going on but you. Because if you're a disciple, you're a desperate. You gave everything to learning, not just to know what your rabbi knows. Anybody can do that. But to doing what your rabbi does. So the rabbi is constantly asking you questions. Who do people say that I am? What do you? Because he wants to know, are you getting it? Are you learning? Are you growing? Are you stretching? Are you? And he's just rattling them endlessly. Really, you think that? Well, let me tell you, I think it's like this. Hey, you guys, come up on this mountain. Check this out. I'm going to talk to Moses, Elijah. You're going to walk. What's he doing? He's calling them along, asking them questions, shaping them. And they don't know what's coming around the next turn. Then he starts talking about his death. And they're like, okay, we're barely tracking with some of that other stuff. And now you're starting to talk about suffering. Where does suffering come in on that? To be a disciple was to be filled with questions and to be following somebody who kept asking questions back. Turn with me over to the book of, let's stay in Matthew. Let's go to chapter, let's go to 14 for now. And then we'll see what happens. Let's see if a second passage starts to take on perhaps some new depth and nuance. Questions as a disciple. Rabbi, what about this? Rabbi, what about this? What about this? Getting stretched. You'd never arrive as a disciple. Always in movement. Where are we going next? Sometimes the rabbi would hike for miles and you'd have to just follow along. You don't know where you're going because you got to trust. You got to learn to trust. Trust the rabbi. Matthew 14. This is a passage where evening came and Jesus comes out. Verse 25, during the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples, they're in a boat, saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost, they said, and cried out in fear. And in the Jewish context, standing water was the place of the abyss. It's where the evil spirits were. That's why the pigs go down the hill into the water. Standing water was always seen as representative of hell, and fresh water was representative of new life. So that's why you don't have like water ski tournaments on the Sea of Galilee right now. It's because there's like a, ooh, standing water, ooh. So when they see him walking on water, they're instantly like, what is this? This is creepy. And one text even says that he saw them and was going to walk on by. I love that. Hey, guys, what's up? So great, isn't it? Verse 27. But Jesus immediately said to them, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. I picture the practical disciple being like, yeah, okay, that's all nice, but you're still walking on water, and it's creeping me out a little bit, I got to be honest. Lord, now remember, Peter is a disciple. If it's you, Peter replied, tell me to come to you on the water. Why is this Peter's first response? Why? He's a Talmid, one of Jesus' Talmidim. Your whole life has been given to what? Doing what your rabbi does. Is it you? Okay. You see your rabbi doing something. Your whole life has been oriented around what? Doing what you see your rabbi doing. So his first impulse. Oftentimes it's like, man, he was kind of rash and hasty and didn't think things through. Or he's just really, really passionate about following his rabbi. And oftentimes with Peter, it's pointed out all the kind of blunders and foot in the mouth and kind of the, but maybe Jesus is like, you know what? Give me somebody who's a little wound up, but at least is that passionate about doing it. I can work with that. I can work with that. So Peter jumps out. Come, Jesus said. Then Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came towards Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and he beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You have little faith, he said. You're such a moron. You didn't really think you could do it, did you? I was just messing with you. I thought that... The RIV, it's not yet on the market. We're testing it to see how the words come out. Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You of little faith, he said. Why did you doubt? What does Jesus ask him? Question. A question. Now, the general understanding, from what I can learn around this passage, is that Peter loses faith in Jesus. One basic observation from the text, is Jesus having problems walking on water? No. Jesus is fine. And remember then the rabbinical context. Jesus walks on water. Peter walks on water. Would Jesus say to Peter, come, if he didn't think he could do it? Would he? No, because you're a rabbi. And you poured your energy into raising up many disciples. And so Peter's walking, and he sees the conditions and the wind and the waves, and he starts to sink. And Jesus says, why'd you doubt? Who does Peter doubt? I would suggest that maybe one way to understand it would be that Peter loses faith in himself. Doesn't think he can actually do it. Doesn't think he can actually do it. I mean, Jesus, for a rabbi, the whole rabbinical system was built around the rabbi's belief in the disciple. I've heard lots and lots and lots of sermons about the need, and excellent, well-meaning, much-needed teachings about our need to trust Jesus. But I submit to you, that Jesus trusts his disciples. I've heard lots and lots and lots of wonderful teachings about the need to have faith in God. But the scripture is story after story after story of a God who has faith that people can actually act and work and live in the world in certain ways. So he just keeps following them, saying things like, I chose you from long ago, I got stuff for you to do. I mean, we have faith in God, and God has faith in us. Who has more faith? And perhaps if that's a little like, that's a bit dodgy, how does Jesus end? Book of Matthew. And Jesus says, now you go and make disciples. I'm out of here. I'll be back. It'll be sweet. And he's gone. He's not like, now go and make disciples and I'll kind of hang. I'll send my spirit to guide you and empower you and enlighten you and to carry you along, give you the strength. I'll get you all the resources you need, but I'm gone. I'll be back later. Does he say, now you go and make disciples and watch this church, Jesus movement explode, and then if you screw it up, I'll step right in? No, go and make more Talmidim. So his final thing to them is now you, movement, spread it, carry it. I submit to you that as a follower of Jesus, Jesus has great faith that you can act in the world in revolutionary, culture-transforming kinds of ways. This isn't some sort of like giant humanity pep talk humanism thing. This is just trying to understand that from the scriptures, God has this habit of continually picking people and having faith in them to actually do things in the world. Maybe I could close by just offering a drawing, and so bear with me for a second. I haven't drawn on a Wonder Woman grease board before. How did she know where she parked the plane? You know, I just... It's like being caught in a dream and somewhere in the background is David Copperfield laughing. Those of you, I recommend taking out a fresh sheet of paper. And those of you who are intimidated by my artistic prowess, hang with me. In the upper left, maybe draw an arrow. And then in the upper right, draw a square. And do your best to approximate. I want to conclude by just wrestling for a moment with our communities. You're here because you want to create. I assume that you're part of a community, as I am. And we're trying in our own kind of fumbling sort of way to bring much glory to God by inviting people into the Jesus story. But I can't talk about being a disciple and asking questions and being creative without getting down to the theological issues. So if some of you are like, man, you're going for the theological jugular, yes, I am. So I just want to lay out perhaps a way and a change that I believe is absolutely necessary in the Church of Jesus right now if we're going to become the kind of creative, life-giving force that God created us to be. I don't believe the ultimate issues are about smoke and lights and good media. I believe the ultimate issues are ultimately about what you believe about God, Jesus, salvation, the Bible, and what it means to walk in Olam Abba with the God who created us. So I want to spend a moment and talk to you about a shift that you can have all of the wonderful media in the world, but I think there's something going on here at Fellowship, and if you miss this and think that Fellowship, and even Ed, and I know Ed would back me up, if it's just about kind of having the technology, there's something else going on here. When Ed came to my house, I picked it up. It took 2 minutes to see. That there's something, there's a heartbeat underneath this, and there's a soul and a heartbeat to all creativity. And I think for the church, it means we have to be honest that some of the old yokes have failed us, and it's time to understand a new yoke. Now, in the scriptures, the dominant metaphor for faith, think about Genesis 12. God says to Abraham, go. And for a brilliant background on what's happening there in the history of the world, Thomas Cahill, C-A-H-I-L-L, The Gifts of the Jews, he takes you through the Mesopotamian culture and what it meant for God to say to somebody, go, and they went. There's a whole cycles of life, repeating patterns, worldview that gets shattered in Genesis 12 that we all assume is normal, that was absolutely revolutionary. The Bible was way ahead of its time. But God says to Abraham, go, and Abraham goes. What is the Exodus? It's a group of people who are actually physically moving. What's the exile? A return. What is Jesus doing? Calling disciples, going from village to village, and then his final command to them isn't just stay here. His final command to his disciples is go. And then you have these first Christians trying to figure out, okay, what's it mean? What's it mean when millions of Gentiles, thousands of Gentiles, start becoming Christians and they're not Jewish? Like, does this mean they have to follow all the stuff? I mean, do we say to 45-year-old Gentile men, yes, come follow Jesus. There's a small operation you're going to need to have. You know? No way, dude. No. So what do you have? You have them faced with, okay, the scenery has changed. And are we going to continue to live how it is for us in the past? Or are we going to adapt and innovate and ask the difficult questions about what does it mean for all these Gentiles? The Jerusalem Council in Acts 15 is a group of people in movement. I mean, what does he say in Acts chapter 1? What does the command? Go into all the nations. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and then just keep going. By chapter 8, they're all still hanging out in Jerusalem. And then what does the text say? A great persecution broke out. God's like, okay, if you're not going to leave, I'll find a way to get you to move. It's people in movement. It's movement. I would argue that the central metaphor in the Bible for faith is that of journey. A community of people. Think about the book of Leviticus. Or think about the Ten Commandments. Commandment number, whatever it is. Hey, commandment, here's one of the bit. Could you, like, try not to kill each other? Could you try not to kill each other? By the New Testament, what kind of things are they saying? Greater love has no one than this. So in Exodus, at the very beginning of the movement, it's, hey, could you not kill each other off? By the end of the scripture, become the kind of community where your love for each other is so strong and the bonds are so unbreakable that you wouldn't just not kill, you would give your life for a brother or sister. It's people on a journey. It's people on a journey, and God is crafting and shaping and calling them to more and more obedience, more and more holiness. And it's not this vague kind of, ooh, journey. It's more and more into the people that God originally created us to be. Journey. I would say one of the words that comes up over and over again is it's people in movement. It's people in movement. It's growth. Innovation isn't optional in the book of Acts. It's absolutely necessary for people to hear about God. In the book of Acts, innovation isn't something for cutting-edge churches. Innovation is absolutely necessary for survival and so that people even get to hear about God. Does that make sense? This idea that, well, that church is trying some new stuff, but wait. Innovation is not optional. Like, some Christians get to, but we're, you know, we just concentrate on other things. What? Talking to each other? And so I think what happens is we have to begin to understand that in the scriptures, you are not the same person you were a year ago. You aren't. Your trustees and elders are not the same people they were 2 years ago. And if they are, something is horribly wrong with the journey. Are we tracking with that? Now, I would argue that we live in a day and age where the dominant, or at least the loudest Christian voice or metaphor for theology has been destination. I think you have large numbers of Christians who have been taught that faith is ultimately a destination, and so the dominant paradigm becomes arrival. Now let's trace this for a moment. If your fundamental understanding is arrival, we're there, then the dominant questions become, we're right. And once again, this is a caricature. Everybody else is wrong. We're in, out. The dominant questions become making sure that the box is as clearly defined as possible. I'm not arguing for some sort of like floaty woo. I'm arguing that this is, we're journeying into the heart of God. We're followers of Jesus. We're not up for debate on that. If your understanding is destination, we've arrived, and we're simply telling people how to get in to where we've, how to arrive with us, then what do you do with questions? If you see yourself as the answer person, what do you do when you have questions? What do you do in a community that is built around an arrival understanding when the leader has questions? The leader, no. The leader's supposed to have all the answers. But what happens when you have questions? But if you're on a journey, the assumption is that we're going to have questions. Imagine if you're a leader. Imagine if you're an elder and you have a destination understanding and the pastor comes and says, let's try this. Let's try this new thing. We might really fail, but let's just try it. What are you? No. But if you're on a journey, failure is expected. Yeah, of course. It's because we're following Jesus and we're changing and we're trying to invite more people. I would argue that in a destination understanding, the dominant energy gets spent defending. But you don't defend the thing. You don't defend baby pictures. You don't defend the vacation you just took. You don't defend your favorite new album. You enjoy it, and you invite others to enjoy it with you. I would say that in a journey understanding, the dominant energies become inviting others on the journey. And so what happens is there are these moments of arrival, but they happen within the context of journey. There are these moments of, this is the day I confess that. This is the day, this is the month in which Jesus got a hold of me. I decided to forgive my dad, and it unlocked my walk with God. And so are these moments of arrival and destination, but they happen on this journey. There is this moment of, oh dear God, I am such a sinner and I have so screwed it up and I have no hope outside of this Jesus who keeps appearing to me, calling me and inviting me. If you're on a car trip, and the person in the front row keeps going, hey, we haven't passed that before. Check that out. We haven't driven by that before. Yeah. Yeah, because when you're on a journey, the scenery changes. I would argue that the cultural scenery has changed. And as the Church of Jesus Christ, we have to acknowledge that the scenery has changed. If you're on a car trip with somebody and they go, hey, we passed that before, you're in a cul-de-sac, get out. And as people who want to be, who desperately crave being the people of God and as followers of Jesus, we have to acknowledge that the world around, the scenery has changed. And we can fight it all we want. But the task of the bride is to ask the right questions. How can we invite those in this new world we find ourselves in to the journey? Come. We're following Jesus. We're learning. We're asking questions. We fail. We have successes. But it's a great, great ride. Come on, try it. Try it. What do you got to lose? Try it. Try it. And may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. Thanks.
Now, I want to ask this guy some questions. Man, that Rob, unreal. You know what I was sitting there thinking? I was sitting there going, man, how in the world can someone talk about this information and keep everybody, I mean, that in-depth, that detail on the edge of our seat? I mean, really, this guy's a genius, man. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Really. First thing I want to ask you, Rob, how do you craft a talk, a message, a sermon, whatever you want to do? And when you're thinking about a particular direction or whatever, let's say at Mars Hill, tell me a little bit about the process that you go through to do that. Because I know you have a unique one.
Yeah, man, where do I start? I assume, first and foremost, that the God of universe is present around you, in you, and doing all sorts of amazing things around you. So I begin with the assumption that, first and foremost, you have to have your radar on. God isn't somewhere else. God's doing something. Jesus says, my Father's always at work. So I believe if I followed you around, mm-hmm. I would see the God of the universe at work all over the place. So the first thing I do is I record every impulse, insight, quote. I read a verse, and I think, I have no idea what this verse means.
Okay.
I record that. So in my computer are all these buckets. I call them buckets. It's very technical terms. I just record, you mention a book to me. I read it, and there's like two lines in it. They're like, that is, I'll just file that. I'll make a file in the computer. So I inhale. At the end of the day, I have scraps of paper in my pockets, anything. I'm just mm-hmm. always gathering. And then I just record it. Because you have all this stuff going on, and if you don't record it, you miss it. And so over time, I think the best teachings aren't purchased off a shelf. I think they're grown in your backyard.
Yes.
So I'll live with a teaching for 6 months to a year before I'd ever give it. So
even in teaching at Mars Hill, you'll have that just resonating, and you'll work it over and over for months. Yeah. And then
probably the thing that I did Sunday, the first initial insight, the first like, ooh, that's the technical noise for, I think there's something here. I mean, I probably came across that 2 years ago, that little chunk. It was a quote in a book, and the quote in the book I just typed into my computer. Okay. And it sat there for 2 years because I want to turn my radar on, because now I have that in the back of my head. And I hear the story from somebody in our congregation, and I think, oh, that story is an example of that. Oh, that scripture is an example. And so what happens over time is that I just keep dropping stuff in that bucket. And you cannot have an edit button. You can't be like, well, that doesn't make sense. You have to just inhale and just record it all. One of the things to think about would be when a movie maker makes a movie, there's hours and hours and hours and hours of footage. And some of it's just really bad scenes. Mm-hmm. So I can generally tell how a teaching is going or by the stuff I know is not going to make it into that teaching. So I'll just grow it. It'll just grow and grow and grow over time.
Now, when you deliver it, Rob, what are you thinking about as far as, I mean, keeping the audience interested?
Yeah.
Because that's what's so fascinating. Every time I hear you, it's like I'm on the edge of my seat because every word, but the interest. I mean, how do you do that?
I generally tend to think of it in terms of movement.
Do you mean erase this board for you? This board's kind of hard to erase.
Are those diaper wipes?
They are.
That's awesome.
You know.
That's sweet.
You know, I was speaking the other day, and I used this board, and I couldn't erase something, so I told everybody to turn their head. I just spit on the board, and we erased it. But yeah, let me do that to give you a...
That's an image we're all right now trying to kind of...
Oh, it was terrible.
There we go.
It was terrible.
Maybe... First off, I think there are movements in a teaching. Maybe you, a friend of mine uses the phrase rhythm in the voice, where the teaching starts and it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then it's like the application is 3 points and they all start with the letter P or something. And
yes.
By the first one, you know what the other two are. Obviously an experience none of you have had. But I ask the question, what's the soul of this message? Like when I was talking through some of the stuff about the yoke or whatever, that's just information. So I know that at that moment in the teaching, that's an informational piece, so it's going to have a certain feel to it. So I will like map out the teaching.
Okay.
The intro might be this passage and this story, and I'm going to read the passage and I'm just going to tell the story. But then I got to get a whole bunch of information across in order to begin. So this is an information section. This information just flies. I got to just dump a bunch of stuff. But then coming out of this information, there are 3 questions that I think it forces us to ask.
Okay.
So I call it cinematic. On the wall in my office, I found on the internet marker board wallpaper. So the whole wall I can write on. So I'll write the sermon as big as the wall and ask, like, okay, if there are 3 questions here, I think I slow down here. So speed. So like this is going to be slower, this is going to be faster. Peter, who does Peter doubt? Himself. If you're like, and then who does Peter doubt? No, there's a moment there.
Yes.
There's a moment there. So I realize when I get to the Peter question,
mm-hmm.
I better see the whole teaching and realize that's got to like slow down. Because we got to find the soul of that. What's that? Who does Peter doubt? I want you to be going, who does Peter doubt? And I got to leave some space there. So there's these spaces. You can teach. You can ruin a good teaching by talking. You've got to have these moments where you know the teaching. You know where this teaching has hit you. So I have to trust that where it hit me, it's going to hit these people. So, man, who does Peter doubt? I got to leave like a... There's got to be just a giant space there. I got to respect that and realize this is probably the moment when I stop talking and God does start. So I'll think through where the space is. A lot of okay. times I'll finish a teaching maybe with just... It might have just 2 questions. And the first question might come up, and I might just say, you know what? I have no idea how to apply this passage. But I know that it raises 2 questions for me. At least 2. I'm sure you can find more. And I might just say, first question, da-da-da. I remember doing a thing on John the Baptist. John the Baptist says, he who has 2, give to the one who has none. What do you have 2 of that somebody else has none? Your closet. Your garage.
Mm-hmm.
Your bank. What do you have 2 of? And so the teaching might just land there. I don't know what, all I know is that it ends with, so I don't know if that helps, but I'll think through the teaching, I would say cinematically, just meaning a movie. The reason why it captures your attention is the person has thought through, when is this fast, when is this slow,
yes.
when is this like a really jumpy, when is this, so that's maybe, I don't know
now,
if that
Rob,
helps.
Rob, how much time do you spend, though, on the connective fiber between these points as far as the setups, you'd call it, I guess, transitions, whatever. How do you think through that, or are you just kind of get into the rhythm and the spacing and kind of let that go?
I generally end up with the technical word here is chunks.
Yeah.
I generally end up with, okay, I got a thing about Peter walking mm-hmm. on water, got a thing about covered in the dust of your rabbi, I got
How
these
you,
different...
Yeah.
So I want to find each of these individually. What's that piece look like? So I might end up with 7 of these things. And I want to know what each of them are. How do they feel? How fast do they go? Do I want people reading a screen, looking in their Bible? Do I hand out a prop? Do I want them just concentrating on me as I tell a story? And then from there, it's merely arranging the chunks. I will maybe after the first service, before the second, think, you know what, that chunk goes here. I think I did that last week. After the first service, before the second one, I was like, no, that thing needs to come earlier. And this thing, if you know the chunks well enough, then you can... You have freedom with them to move them around. So,
now, is this stuff like on your computer, or do you write it down? Any notes at all prior to you hitting the stage?
The computer, I use old school outlines, Roman numeral 1, A, 1, 2, Roman B, Roman mm-hmm. numeral 2. Is it old school, the thing that your grammar teacher
retro
wanted you to do? Yeah, yeah. It's all highly structured. And yeah, retro. I was just sort of thinking of.
Yeah.
Be a great idea for a series. You ought to use it. And
that's good.
So it has to have an inner logic and cohesion.
Sure.
It can't. When someone's like, you know, I just go with the Spirit, I immediately like, I mean, yeah, you go with the Spirit. But if the Spirit's present when you're just talking off the top of your head in a room full of people, then the Spirit can be present in your office as you're working through this thing really truly being a good thing.
Yes,
so
yes,
kind of that.
Yes,
my
good.
Thing is I want to have lots of ammo. I want to have this thing so worked through. To me, freedom comes from the hard work you've put in. The listening to the
Man,
Spirit.
Man, I hope you don't miss that. That is, yes,
to me,
that's rich.
To me, if I have... Did you just slap yourself in
that's
the face?
That's rich, yes.
That was awesome.
Thank you.
To me, the freedom comes. I know this thing so well. It's so deep within me that I can step outside of my Roman numerals and my boxes because I sense God is doing something here in the room. And then I can just step right back in. That to me is the issue, is I have these boxes and squares and I know the overall movements. But it has to be so internalized that then you have the freedom to go, oh, there's something new in that. I can explore that more.
Rob, you know, last night we were talking about Bishop T.D. Jakes, and Bishop has said before, I've read this, where the same thing you said, when he feels like he's really struck a chord, when he feels the presence of God, when he sees mm-hmm. and knows the reaction, he will camp out there during a message. And I think what you said is exactly right, because you know it so well,
yeah.
You have the opportunity to move off. And I truly believe that the greatest creativity, Rob, and innovation, I said this yesterday, comes from order. God's a God of order. And within that, man, that's when creativity
soars.
And I want to go back to something you said earlier, which I thought was so profound, is that, and this is what I got out of it, innovation is not optional. So the question should not be, you know, how does my church become, or how does my teaching become innovative? The question should be, what's keeping me, I guess, from really unleashing that in my life? Talk to me about creativity and change, like in, I guess, in the context of preaching and all that. It's whatever hits you.
Number one, to me, Ed doesn't teach. He's a teacher, which is a huge difference. His whole life is oriented around teaching. So it's not one of the like little kind of tasks that he does. He's purposely thought through, how do you set up a life that allows you to be somebody who, a teaching kind of life? If you, I need lots of time staring out the window. I can't walk in. I have this 2-hour chunk where I'm supposed to study. I walk in, kind of input a bunch of stuff, and then it's, that's why Ed fishes so much. It's because I guarantee you the best stuff has come from fishing. And I, like, when was the last time, maybe a question to ask would be, when was the last time you spent a half day in silence? Because creativity comes out of the soul. You don't purchase it off a shelf. It's grown in your backyard. Mm-hmm. And the true divine spark, the true divine spark that God births in you with an idea comes when God's voice is louder than everything else. And if I always have a constant stream of phone calls, when do you turn your cell phone off and when can I not get a hold of you? Because until there are rhythms and disciplines where there's no other voice coming at you, that's when the creativity is birthed. So, and this has taken me years to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
I often, like, if I will try to balance an hour of study or research with a run or a workout, because it's in those moments when all the stuff that's come in starts to, like, trickle down and starts to, I use the phrase marinade.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll tell my wife, like, hey, check this out. Genesis 11, and I'll have those, and she'll just go, it needs a little more marinade. Which means it's a bit wobbly. So I think that you have to understand as a teacher that silence and solitude and reflection aren't options for Henry Nouwen and people like that. and you have to run a church, you have to begin to see that some of your most serious work is the silence and solitude. Even for the people who you elders or staff or whatever, yes. That day you're not there because you're taking a walk. You're very busy taking a walk that day. That's what our communities need. People who have done the hard work and discipline of spending time alone in silence. That's where the creative impulse, would you agree to that?
I totally agree.
So I think what Ed and Lisa were talking about yesterday, these are lifestyle. These aren't going to come if you just time manage Tuesday afternoon a little better. These are ways of thinking about the rhythms of your life. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I think what's happened, one of the dangers is that in our culture, is, and especially among pastors, is that, well, I got to run the church.
Yeah.
But no, you don't. God runs the church. Mm-hmm. You listen. And I think that's a huge thing we have to make, is that when you're reading some books that have nothing to do with that particular sermon series, or when you're taking a, that's going to pay off at some point. That's going to lead to an insight. That's going to shape you. And that's one of the big. And then I inhale new ideas. So, books, magazines. I inhale. I have to have like 100 ideas coming in. I have to be just inhaling stuff.